The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and this is my syndicated talk radio show. I want to welcome 103.5 FM from Asheville, North Carolina. And if you're listening, I promise to get to work on doing those promos for your radio station. Thanks for having me. And I want to thank Joe the Archivist from our own PRN Radio for doing that lovely voiceover, bringing my books into the voiceover, because I've realized again and again that the names of my books are actually better known than my own name. I want to remind folks that we are getting closer and closer to April 8th, 9th, and 10th to our conference on empathic therapy in Syracuse, New York. We are going to have folks from all over the world coming to join us as participants. Many from Asia and also from Africa and the Middle East and Europe, Australia. It's going to be a marvelous group of people. And we're going to hear presenters talking about a huge variety of subjects, from the abuse of our children with diagnoses of ADHD and medication for ADHD here in the United States. And also in Australia, we're going to have a member of parliament who's fighting these issues in Australia. We're going to have experts from the military talking about attempts to get away from using psychiatric drugs to treat stress and head injury in soldiers, to find better, more caring, more empathic methods. We're going to learn how Columbia, South Carolina, a friend of mine, a psychiatrist, is helping street people who are psychotic learn to rehabilitate themselves. You're going to learn from Howie Glasser how to find your greatness and how to help other people find their greatness. And you're going to see my first training film, the premiere of my first training film on how to do empathic therapy. And a marvelous panel of families injured by psychiatric drugs, including the loss of children through suicide. And you're going to hear a lawyer and me, along with the families, talk about these tragic situations. It's going to be an uplifting and insightful 3 days in Syracuse, New York. And you can get online to empathictherapy.org. empathictherapy.org, and find out about the conference, sign up, do it before we run out of hotel rooms, and then you'd have to stay next door in yet another hotel. Be right there with us. My guest tonight, well, maybe you're getting used to great guests, but we're going to continue to outdo. My guest tonight is John Virapin. You're going to hear more and more about this man. He's the author of Side Effects Death, Confessions of a Pharmaceutical Insider. John was the managing director of the Swedish division of Eli Lilly. Now, those of you who have read my books, heard me talk about these issues, know that I took on Eli Lilly as perhaps the first professional ever to do so. I was the medical expert for over 150 combined cases against Eli Lilly in the 1990s for Prozac causing violence, suicide, death, mayhem, etc. And I learned quickly about just how destructive Eli Lilly can be. Because the first trial, where all the cards were being laid out on the table and the world was watching and hundreds of lawyers were watching, Eli Lilly boldly went where no other company had ever gone, and they fixed the trial. They actually prearranged for our side to pull its punches. They prearranged for our side to put in a weak case so that Lilly would win, and they paid off my side. And that led to me not knowing what in the world was going on. What in the world was going on? And my wife first figured out that it was a setup. The setup was not only to throw the trial, but to undermine me as the main medical expert against Eli Lilly. So I was up against Lilly, and I was up against my own side. Didn't figure it out for quite some time until it came out that Lilly had fixed the trial, and the judge actually reversed the verdict and changed it from a jury verdict, which was barely in favor of Lilly, I think a 9-3 vote, and changed it to a settlement with prejudice by Eli Lilly. A secret settlement had been conducted. I could go on about that, but I don't want to take up John's time, except to tell you that this man has a lot in common with me. I came and spoke out from within psychiatry against what my profession and Eli Lilly were doing, and he has spoken out from inside, confessions of a pharmaceutical insider, John Verapen, author of Side Effects, Death. John, hello. And welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm especially good because you're on the show. John, maybe start out and tell people about these incredible events where you felt you could no longer, that you could no longer work for Eli Lilly and that you had to go public.
Well, it's not a matter of me not longer wanting to work with Lilly. They fired me. They fired me and they rigged everything because I knew too much. And the man who was responsible for the success of Prozac, he was about to become the chairman of the board. He used to be my boss indirectly by a middleman. And they set me up just like they did with you. And they fired me. Now, I did not come out talking, you know, about all the atrocities this company does. I didn't know anything else. I had to make a living, so I was recruited by another pharmaceutical company, and I thought I'd stay on. And then I retired after some years working for several other major players. And when I saw that some famous psychiatrist, Dr. Biedemann, I think he's called, he started propagating for the use of Prozac on children and other SSRIs. That made me mad, red. At the same time, I had a little son born. And when I looked at the boy and looked at what I've been through and what I know, I said to myself, this cannot go on. And that's when I started to write the book and expose all the atrocities that I've been through, especially with Prozac, because I was the first person within the industry for a pharmaceutical company that submitted the registration for that drug in Sweden. At that time, Sweden was a forerunner in terms of approval, the board of approval. Even the FDA consulted with the Swedes because they were so good and they were so rigorous and so strict. Until I came along, because the Swedes were willing to accept a bribe, well, a professor of psychiatry, he was willing to accept a bribe, which Lilly literally forced me to do, because they needed Prozac so badly on the market. And with the registration coming from Sweden, that would give them more ammunition to tell the rest of the world, hey, Sweden has registered this product or approved it, which means it's good.
They basically told you, John, to go ahead and bribe a key figure in Sweden who is a professor in order to get the drug Prozac approved in Sweden?
Not like that. Indirectly. Because this drug was very important to them, because they had just lost another big drug that was supposed to be the first blockbuster in the world. They spent millions and millions of dollars on that drug. And that was taken off the market because of suppression of side effects, and the drug just killed a lot of people. So Prozac became the drug to replace that, because their pipeline was getting dry. Now, in Sweden, in those days, it would take up to about 7 years to get approval for a new drug. But they couldn't wait 7 years. And I told them that. They said, well, you have to get this thing registered as fast as possible. Do what you can. Your job could be on the line. That's what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
By people in very, very high places. Anyway,
what were you told to do? Can you tell us what you were told to do?
Pardon?
Can you tell us what you were told to do?
I was told to do whatever it takes. Those are the exact words. Whatever it takes. Now, I went out and started researching ways of getting this done. And the only way I knew how to get it done was to find the consultant clinician or psychiatrist who would give the approval of the clinical evaluation. In Sweden, they would take a new drug and give it to a specialist who is a consultant to the board. And that consultant does the clinical evaluation, and he gives it thumbs up or thumbs down. So we had to look for this guy. Well, simple logic prevailed, and I found him. So I befriended him. And, I even went and read about boats, because he was crazy about sailing and boats and whatever. Anyway, we became friends, and in a beautiful restaurant setting one night, I popped the question. I said, look, how can we get this drug through? And he says, what drug? He was playing games with me, too. So I said, Prozac. He laughed. He said, that drug could never get registration in Sweden because it's rubbish. It's no good. And I said, well, there's something you can do. You're the man. And he laughed. He took another sip of the wine, an expensive wine that I bought for him. And he said, money is always good. And then I popped a question, how much? And he told me, and I went back to the company and told them, look, this is what it's going to take. And they said, go ahead. I said, well, you guys set up the financial arrangements, and I will talk to the guy and let him go ahead. And that's how it was done.
Now, John, is this
promised,
in your
apart
book?
From the cash, he was promised a 10-year study at his clinic because he needed the money to continue with his clinic, to pay his staff and things like that. Well, you know how it goes with these clinical trials. And that trial alone would have involved many, many, many millions of dollars. I don't know what happened after they took me away to Puerto Rico, because the whole thing fell apart. The registration process at this Board of Health, nothing happened until a few years later it was registered. And I'm pretty sure that was registered with corruption money anyway, so.
John, do you discuss this in your book, Side Effects Death?
Yes.
Okay, good. What else went on that would interest folks who want to know the kind of manipulation that goes on behind the scene?
Well, I've spent close to 35 years in the business. And if I count the years that I've been working now against this industry, it's almost 40 years, more than half of my life. I cannot say that I've done anything that would you would call spectacular in terms of a career or whatever. It was corruption and corruption and corruption. I didn't pay much notice to it because at that stage in my career, or in the whole time in the industry, it was a matter of living the good life, you know, the jet set life.
Yeah.
Travel all over the world. You see the five-star hotels in all the capitals, the nice airports, and the wine, women, song, the whole shamongan.
Yeah. You know, John, I obviously can't verify the story you're telling, although I certainly trust you, but I can tell you that I had my own shocking discoveries when I was looking inside Eli Lilly as the medical expert for all the combined Prozac suits. I found out that the Germans were becoming suspicious that patients were killing themselves on Prozac, and they asked Eli Lilly to review its controlled clinical trials to see if they had increased rates of suicide or suicide attempts. So Lilly went ahead and actually counted. Imagine, for the first time, they counted the number of suicide attempts in their controlled clinical trials for Prozac compared to the sugar pill and compared to an older antidepressant. And depending on how they counted, they got a 12 to 1 increase in the number of suicides in the suicide attempts in the group on Prozac. And their own analysis came out with a borderline statistical correlation. And that was after they unethically threw out a bunch of the cases. After the cases that had been predetermined during the study to be suicide attempts on the drug, they then decided weren't. And when they threw out four or five of them, they still got evidence of suicidality on Prozac. And what Eli Lilly did was never report this to the FDA or to the German agency or to anyone. And then I made this public finally and wrote about it in some of my books. Tried to tell the FDA, and the FDA didn't care. Does this surprise you?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of the memo that was sent to Lilly from Germany after their submission for registration. And the Germans wrote in that memo that they're not going to register this drug because it has too many side effects and they don't think it works. After that, I don't know what happened, but I've been trying to get the...
They approved it. Germany eventually approved it.
Eventually
unlike
approved
Unlike the
it.
U.S., they put in that, as I recall, that there was a risk of suicidality or agitation or anxiety early in the treatment,
yes,
and that tranquilizers should be given.
Yes.
That's off the top of my head.
Well, that's the memo I have when the Germans said no, and they were literally... saying, hey, this product is nothing. Just come with something else or just, you know, disappear. Yeah. But
now they got talked into doing to approving it with some caveats. Which
shortly was... after, I think a year or so after, they registered the drug. And I've been, there's some other people involved here in Germany who have been asking for documentation to show why they changed their minds, the German authorities. They don't want to come with anything. They don't have anything. So that leads me to believe it must have happened the way I did it in Sweden.
God, that's really amazing, John. Another thing, you talk about memos. When I was doing this research as the expert for the cases, I found two memos from Europe to America, to central office Eli Lilly, from Eli Lilly people in Europe, saying that they were ashamed that they were being told to reclassify a doctor's report on the drug, that when a doctor doing the study would send in a report saying suicide attempt, they were being told to reclassify it as something more harmless, like no drug effect. And they, one of the memos, which it's in my book, Talking Back to Prozac, which is out now with a new introduction, Talking Back to Prozac by myself and Ginger. The memos are in there. And one of them actually says, what would I tell a judge? What would I tell our critics? What would I tell my family that I did these things? This was a memo inside Eli Lilly.
Well, I have that memo. I'm probably the only one now that has a copy of that, except if you have one in your book. But I have that memo.
Yeah.
And this is the way Eli Lilly and company operates. And it's not only in psychiatry. They do it in a lot of other specialty areas with their drugs. They word themselves out when it comes to clinical evaluation. I myself have participated in and seen them suppress side effects of a drug because they did not want to lose their image or they did not want to lose the registration. For example, when I submitted the file in Sweden for a registration or marketing approval, they started a local trial because all, many countries, they require that you do a local study for registration purposes. They started one in one of the largest or the largest hospital in Sweden with a colleague of yours, a very famous lady in psychiatric circles. I think she was president of some world association or whatever. And at her clinic, they started this little study. I think it was about 12 patients or something. And the first, at the start of the study, two patients tried to kill themselves after a couple of days. And all hell broke loose in my office in Stockholm. You know, all the medical people from England, from Indianapolis, they all came running in and want to see what's going on. They even put me out of my own office when they were discussing this because they didn't want me to get involved. But I had ways of listening to them in that office, so I knew what was going on. And they simply just shut the study down.
Yeah.
This is a very, very frequent use of hiding negative information of their drugs. Not only Lilly, most of the companies do that because there's a law in America that protects them, that they're not allowed to give out any kind of information that is classified confidential or classified. And they shut down the study and still went in to get the approval because this consultant man had received his money and he was he gave a favorable approval of the product. Now, what people don't know, I had sent my medical associate, spent a whole day in a hotel room in one of the cities in Sweden with the file where this man instructed her how to rewrite the whole thing so it falls in their favor. Because the studies that they had presented for the registration of this product was just rubbish. You don't do studies like that. I mean, they had a multi-centered study, this, I don't know, you may have heard of it, Protocol 27?
Yeah.
That was the most atrocious study ever done. And there are many people who have written reports about that on the Internet. Anyway, the bottom line is that these people, they function on corruption.
Now, do you think this is as thoroughgoing outside of psychiatry? Because the area I know is psychiatry, and I've been shocked every time I've looked inside at what's been going on. I could tell you more stories about Eli Lilly. I can tell you about Lilly shutting down a study in China that was indicating increased rates of abnormal behaviors on Prozac. Upjohn shutting down a study, I think it was in France, but I may be wrong on that. That was showing suicide behaviors on Xanax. So in psychiatry, this is a very thoroughgoing phenomenon. Do you think it's just as bad throughout the pharmaceutical industry?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have personally been involved in shutting down a study in other areas of medicine. And this goes on all the time. The bad news, as I see it today, knowing much more than when I stopped working in the business, is that they get away with it because they get the backup from the justice system. I mean, they're not liable to show what they're doing in their research, yet they go out and tell the world, our research, our integrity, we come with innovative medicine to help people and help humanity. They don't fit together.
Yeah, you know, in the trial that I told you about, which was the Westbecker case, the official name is Fentress.
Yeah, I know that one very well. Right?
Yeah. Well, I was the guy. I was in the middle of it. One of the big issues, of course, was Lilly was claiming to the jury that it had this marvelous history when, in fact, their executives have been convicted of criminal behavior in regard to an earlier drug. And as a part of the agreement to throw the trial, our side never brought up the earlier conviction. I forget the name of the drug now, but you probably remember. Aura something. I can't remember the exact name of what the drug was, but literally Lilly was claiming these marvelous things about
that's
itself.
That's the drug I was talking about just before Prozac came out. Auraflex.
Yes, Auraflex.
And they had
criminal convictions for the U.S. Justice Department in that case. And now there are $1 billion fines being paid by these companies, but they make it a part of doing business.
The drug you were talking about, Auraflex or Benoxaprofen, there are so many skeletons hidden in that closet. Lilly would do anything for it to stop it from coming into court. And this is what happened in that case, where they did not know that the defense had managed to get that case admitted in court. That's why they went in a hotel room and settled the case behind the judge's back. And the case with that Benoxaprofen, you know what the fines were? $15,000.
Yeah. You know, John, I think they were actually fixing the trial even before it began, because my side wasn't preparing me for the trial. It was very strange. They stopped sending me discovery. I kept working on discovery. When I got to the trial, they put me in a separate hotel and hid information from me that had been collected that was very relevant to my testimony, and then refused to practice me for my testimony. So I'm very clear that the fix had started before the trial. It may just have grown with the Auraflex issue coming forward. This was all orchestrated, even making Wes Becker the first case had to have been orchestrated because it was the worst case we had. They still almost lost
well,
it. But it was a very complicated case and shouldn't have come first.
The lawyer that was involved in that case,
Smith,
he brought me into Atlanta to witness against Lily on a suicide case of a man that shot himself after a week on Prozac. And during the I was there, and they had, like, in a court, I came over to Atlanta, and Lily's lawyers, they were sitting there and grilling me for 2 days. And in the end, the judge refused to admit my testimony. Because
John, we're gonna take a break now. We'll pick up with what you're saying about your testimony and the judge not admitting it when we come back. And we're also going to take a caller who apparently became suicidal on one of the antidepressants. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. You're listening to John Virapen.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network,
starting March 3rd.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and I'm talking with John Virapen, V-I-R-A-P-E-N, former managing director of Eli Lilly Sweden. And we have a couple of callers that I want to get to with some relevant questions. John, finish up with what you were saying about how the judge wouldn't let in your testimony.
Well, they claim that the man that I was talking about, he was the chairman of the board of Eli Lilly and Company, and they claim that he had to be in court as a witness based on what I was saying, but then the claim came that this man is an apex, I don't know, some apex person in a huge corporation, and he cannot be called into court. But at the time when he performed what I did, gave the approval for corruption, he wasn't the chairman of the board. He was not an apex. He was an ordinary manager just like me, but he was a vice president or president of international at the time. So the court took his side, and at that time, when this case, when I went up to do the case, he had become the chairman of the board, and he was a very good friend of George Bush, the last one, not the father. And by the way, the father was a member of the board of Eli Lilly and Company before he became president. And the Bush family, as such, owns, I don't know if they own half of the company or more, but they're heavily invested in that company. So, being the friend of, because this man was made a member of the Homeland Security after being in the U.S. only 3 years, because he was a friend, George Bush appointed him there as a... So, the connections they get away with. And remember, the people in Indianapolis all that surround Eli Lilly and Company, they're in Congress. I mean, right now you have one guy is a governor now, Mitch Daniels. He used to work for Eli Lilly and Company. The father was on the board of health, George Bush's father. So they get away with murder, these people.
And these are the people that I began taking on all by myself in psychiatry in the 1990s. It's a blessing I'm still alive, John, and it's a marvel that you're alive as well.
Well,
we have some callers, John.
Now.
Let me take a couple of callers.
I'm continuing. I will continue with this as far as I can go.
And you so know? We will both. We have that in common.
Yeah, well, not only that, I've now decided to go political, which I would not discuss with you on the radio here, but it's there's so much politics involved that it forces me to go into the political side of things, and I'm also going global because it's not only psychiatry. Psychiatry is one of the worst segments of medicine that these people are annihilating. I call it the silent holocaust. That's what I would say.
Well, my experience would certainly confirm that, just looking at psychiatry and the number of casualties. We now have, and then I want to get to a caller, but we now have an article, a new February issue of Archives of General Psychiatry, confirming that the brain damage in people labeled schizophrenic is not from themselves, but from the neuroleptic drugs. This is now a new big finding. I'm shocked that it actually came out in the archives. I've been writing about this for 20 years, and I have a lot of material on brain damage from all the psychiatric drugs in my book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. Kevin, are you on the line? We still have Kevin with us, the caller?
I am certainly on the line. How are you today?
Hi. Now, Kevin, you had a story you wanted to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually recently put on a drug called Celexa, one of the SSRIs that you were formerly mentioning, to which I had suicidal ideations within 24 hours of taking the medication. And subsequently, within about 9 days of taking the medication, I did try to commit suicide. It was a horrible experience, and for me, it kind of destroyed my life. I was formerly, and will be again, a student studying mental health law to try to protect people of this, and I had to subsequently leave that environment due to this affliction. And I just kind of wanted to tell people about it.
Well, I'm glad you're alive, obviously. A lot of doctors think that, well, it couldn't have been the Celexa, which is citalopram, because you only had one dose and the drug doesn't begin to work for 6 weeks, according to folklore in psychiatry. I had to look into this for legal cases that I was involved in, and I actually found that a lot of the worst psychiatric adverse effects, like suicidality, occur after one, two, or three doses. Was involved in a case with Paxil where a man took one dose, maybe two, and drowned himself and his two little children in a tub. So, yes,
actually,
the first dose
can
get you.
I think I read about that case with you.
Kevin, I hope you will come to our conference. Look it up on empathictherapy.org. And if you'd like to talk to me personally about what happened to you, call my public office phone, 607-272-5328. And leave a message, and I'll get back to you. And I appreciate your sharing this with us. And you can get the phone also off of my website, okay?
I will absolutely do that. And thank you very much for all you do. And hopefully I'll be able to continue to support you when I go back to law school.
Well, that's great. And maybe, you know, come to our conference. We're going to have a whole workshop, a plenary headed by a chairwoman whose 9-year-old daughter committed suicide on Zoloft. And the lawyer's going to be there, Carl Putil, and I'm the medical expert. That's going to be one of the more fascinating presentations ever at a conference in our field.
And
thank you for calling in.
And of course, very sad. So I appreciate it.
Okay. And we have a caller, Andy, from the Bronx, who wanted to talk about antidepressant studies.
Question for you about the studies.
You're Andy. Hi, Andy.
Yes. How you doing, Dr. Ray? I'm a big fan, by the way. But I'm interested in by what method the studies were performed on depression, on the antidepressants, to make a determination of improvement or not improvement. Because I don't have, or anybody else have access to really see that part of the studies. Whenever you see these studies on efficacy for ECT or antidepressants or anything like that, it doesn't get into that type of detail. But you've seen that you've been able to access those that information, and I don't see how they can really. I don't even agree with the depression of diagnosis on a scientific level anyway. So my question is, how was the determination made that a person gets less depressed during treatment? How is that made? By the response of the patient to questions, by the doctor, by the patient's family, or is an assessment just made by the
I can answer all that for you, and I'm going to ask John to respond too. First, I go into this in great detail in Talking Back to Prozac, which is now an e-book as well. You can find it on my website, Bregan.com, in great detail. In regard to Prozac, and in regard to many of these studies, basically there's a checklist of symptoms like weight gain, weight loss, sleeping, not sleeping, that is checked off by the psychiatrist or the nurse, more often just a nurse or whoever is really conducting the study, which is not usually the person in charge of the study. And these tests have not been verified. They haven't been cross-checked with other tests. They're very primitive. And then they have tests where the patients rate themselves. But they almost never use those. They usually throw them out because the patients almost never rate themselves as improved. Furthermore, the docs and the raters can usually tell who's on the drug. For example, it's easy to tell who was on Prozac rather than the sugar pill because they'd get agitated, they'd have trouble sleeping, they'd be edgy, a little more anxious. So the docs knew who to rate as improved because they could tell who was on the Prozac. But with it all, They could barely approve Prozac without giving sedatives, which was illegal according to the rules of the study. They gave sedatives to calm the patients down, or they would have had so much anxiety they couldn't approve the drug. So it's a lot of hocus pocus. It's done by heavily invested doctors who are part of the old boys network that these drug companies support. But I talk about it in depth in Talking Back to Prozac, and also to some extent in my brain disabling treatments in psychiatry. John, well, you want to add anything to that?
Let me ask you this, doctor. How could you possibly control for change in life circumstance?
So, well, you can do a controlled study that hopefully will eradicate those differences. If you had 1,000 people on the drug and 1,000 people on placebo, in the case of Eli Lilly, I think they ended up with 250 finishers, not the 10,000 they claim. But you could control for factors if you had a big enough study. But it's very hard to control for the fact that you can tell who's on the drug because of the side effects of the drug. And when you give a placebo that has side effects, let's say you give Benadryl or something that's going to give you a dry mouth and has side effects, the meta-analyses show, in fact, that the antidepressants don't work. They're no better than placebo. They really are no better than placebo. I'd like to get back to John now. Thank you for calling. John, your response.
Yeah, well, Andy was his name.
Yeah.
If you're still listening, Andy, all I can tell you is that when it comes to studies about anything regarding the psychiatric section of medicine, it's all nothing. It's useless. I'm like you. I'm still looking for a definition, a clear definition of depression. And I'm still trying to figure out all these different criteria in their measurement and diagnosis in psychiatry, like the Bible of psychiatry, the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual. That thing changes every year 300-400 times. So these people don't know what they're doing. And like Dr. Biedemann, who started it on children, and that man is evil. He's just like Eli Lilly and company. They're both evil. He did an interview with a journalist, and this is published on the internet. Anybody can go and read that. The journalist asked him who he was. He said he was a professor. And then the guy said, well, what's this professor? He says, full professor. And the journalist says, what is full professor? He says, next to God. So that leads me to conclude that psychiatrists, well, not Peter, of course, he's doing something different. Psychiatrists, they believe they're God. They're working with the mind of human beings, and there's no human ever will be able to do anything with the human mind.
Humility. We need so much more humility when we try to help people.
The pharmaceutical industry has got a grip on researchers, for example. A company can go in, like Eli Lilly and company as an example, they can go to one of these CROs, clinical research organization, present a protocol to them that will give them their desired results. It's never real. It's all fake.
And the FDA doesn't look deeply into the data. It pretty much looks at the data summaries. And I actually would go inside and still do as a product liability expert against these companies and look at the data. And I used to beg the FDA, read my books, read my articles, bring me in to tell you what's inside, what the data really is, because they are culling the data they give you. But the FDA has never wanted to know what really goes on inside these companies. The people who are at the FDA are either political appointees at the very top, or if they're more the people doing the vetting and the examinations of the drugs, they, when they retire, want to go work for drug companies.
Not only that, the whole lot of them in the FDA and other approval agencies, they're all corrupt. They get paid. And I can prove that because I did it. I did it myself. And the other thing is, Peter, can you tell me if you know how many people read package inserts of these drugs that they get?
Oh, practically no one. And they're not even very accessible.
You know who writes the package inserts? The pharma companies.
Well, it's more complicated than that. The inserts, as you know very well, they're kind of a bargaining that goes on back and forth between the drug company and the FDA, the drug company and the FDA. And that's a part of what would take months and months. People thought that, hey, the drug takes 10 years to approve. It must have been studied for 10 years. Now the drug studies are 4, 6, 8 weeks long, but the haggling over the package insert may go on for years.
Well,
so it is something that goes back and forth between the FDA and the companies.
The package insert of anything that we send in for approval. I mean, for Prozac in Sweden, my medical associate wrote with instructions from the company how it should be written. This shouldn't be said and that shouldn't be said.
Right, right. Well, that's the drug company side. But there's also activities on the FDA side where they're telling the drug companies what they want to hear. They ask for more information. They rearrange things. In fact, and they'll sometimes do it just on behalf of the drug company. The package insert, that is the FDA-approved label for the drug, which for those of us who don't know all about that, you will see a summary of that on the back of all the advertisements you see in your magazines or in the also in journals. Just before Prozac was approved, the label read that the most common adverse effects of Prozac were depression and abnormal thoughts. And they were both taken out. The FDA took out that the drug caused depression just before approving the label. That's how corrupt it is.
Yep. And it's ongoing. It's not only in psychiatry. All their medicines. So, you know, you're walking up a high slope here. But I'm going to get to the top. Somehow, people have to understand, this is the key thing, that people should not think of their doctors anymore as demigods, especially psychiatrists. They should ask them questions. Because the patients are not patients, they are consumers.
There's no question, John, that psychiatry is now an arm of the pharmaceutical industry. That's all psychiatrists do is push drugs now. They hardly do another thing. I say that as a psychiatrist with remorse about my profession, but it's just an arm of the pharmaceutical industry.
Do you know if you go to a psychiatrist's office, you see all these lovely paintings on the wall and leather sofas and stuff like that? Do you know who pays for that? Not the psychiatrist. Those are little goodies that they get from the industry.
Yeah, I think it varies a lot. And there's being somewhat of a crackdown, but they do. They give vacations. They give dinners. And, of course, they fund the journals. They fund the conferences. And the average psychiatrist nowadays pretty much goes along with what the drug companies are saying. Instead of using caution and waiting a year or two or three or four before trying a new drug, they literally believe what they're told by the salespersons, and they just start dispensing drugs, and you become the guinea pig because it's impossible to find out right away what drugs are really doing.
While we were waiting for the registration in Sweden, I took, personally, on behalf of the company, I took 25 psychiatrists down to Puerto Rico.
Oh, my God. That's marvelous.
You know where I
love it.
You know,
Did you have a nice time?
Every night we had dinners, fancy dinners, and you know, a lot of perks. Nighttime, these guys want to visit the whorehouse.
Oh, God, John.
Which I accommodated. It's a very famous place in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I don't want them to do any advertising for them, but I could tell you the name of the place. But I used to take these guys, several of them, every night. Every night.
Now, this is 25 Swedish psychiatrists?
Psychiatrists.
From Sweden?
Yes.
That's a significant percentage of Swedish psychiatrists. How many were there?
Well, 25 of them.
No, how many in all of Sweden?
I don't know. I don't remember this count.
I mean, that's a significant representation, and probably they were leaders.
Well, there wouldn't
opinion
be a
leaders.
Conference if they were not leaders, because they were invited depending on their prescription habits.
Oh, okay. These were prescribers.
Yeah.
What years are you talking about?
I'm talking about first three, 4 years in the 80s, 84, 85.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, what goes on behind the curtain of this industry as a whole? I mean, and now I'm only telling you about what I've been through while in the West. I've had responsibilities down in Latin America, and I also work for the Citalopram people and the Caribbean, the all Caribbean area. And what they do down there, I haven't started to talk about yet.
Well, listen, we have about three more minutes for you, maybe 2 minutes. Give us a summary. Tell people where your book is Side Effects, Death, Confessions of a Pharmaceutical Insider. This is John Virapen, V-I-R-A-P-E-N. John, how can people contact you?
Well, they can contact me on my website, johnvirapen.com, or john-virapen.com. You can send me a mail at mail@johnvirapen.com. And if you want to buy the book is available on Amazon. And you get it in all the distributors, Barnes & Noble, Ingram. It's all over the U.S. And, if you want to contact me, you can just put mail at my website, john-virapen.com.
John, thank you very much for being on the show. John was originally planning to come to our conference April 8th through 10th, but is going to be unable to make it. So I hope in a year from now, John, that you'll be able to come over and spend some time with us and meet Ginger. And thank you very, very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's hard for me to know how to conclude after a show like this. I think that I would say be cautious. Trust that your brain is a marvelous and delicate instrument, that it houses your soul and your spirit. Protect it, guard it, nurture it. This is Peter Bragan saying goodbye.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.